Number 191552, Roderick J. Taylor v. Sean Medeiros.
Thank you.
Good morning. May it please the Court, Dana Curhan for Roderick Taylor. I won't be reserving rebuttal time. I'll just go straight through. We challenge the prosecutor's closing statement. I think the district judge and the SJC both agreed that there was some error there. I think the most egregious errors were the attacks on the personal attacks on defense counsel, and more specifically accusing him of fabricating a defense and characterizing it as a bald-faced lie. There were a couple of other issues that were raised. I think probably for purposes of due process analysis, this case rises and falls on the first one, but I think the reference to the failure to testify and the what we contend is a mischaracterization of the of certain evidence or the sort of vouching for certain evidence, that really places this in context, because this is not a couple of isolated remarks in an otherwise exemplary jury argument. This was a prosecutor over the course of a 35-page argument continually going up to the line, sometimes crossing it, and then coming up with a couple of pretty egregious statements that I think we can all acknowledge were improper.
Where do you see that there was a comment by the prosecutor on his failure to testify? Where do you see that?
There were a couple of things where a couple of statements where he said, you know, you didn't hear about this. Let me see if I can find that specifically.
Well, let me just, for your benefit, counsel, one of the statements you cite in your brief, I think it would appear to be a comment on an arguable inconsistent statement that he made. Now, he didn't testify, but it's the prosecutor seems to be pointing out an inconsistency in his statement. This is about his presence at Martha Lang's house, and
yes,
there seems to be there seems to be a basis for arguing that he made an inconsistent statement with respect to that aspect of the case. So why can't the prosecutor point out that inconsistency?
Well, I mean, I think it was a sort of an inartful way of pointing this out. The first statement, I have no idea where Mr. Taylor was when he made those calls early in the morning of the state. Nobody does except for the defendant. And then the next one was, not one witness in this case puts the defendant at Martha Lang's house. Not one, not any of the witnesses. Mr. Swanley called. Marie Anderson doesn't say that. Martha Lang doesn't say that. And you know who else doesn't say that? The defendant doesn't say that. I suppose you could
arguably that's a commentary on what he said.
It's a commentary on what the defendant didn't say. And when you say that he didn't say that, he didn't testify. And a jury could look at that and say he didn't testify. Now, again, I don't contend, standing alone, that's an error, but I don't think it's an error that rises to the level of due process. But I think it puts in context the first argument, the references to the commentary on defense counsel fabricating a defense. And I think when you look at that, and you look at that in the context of an argument that was less than ideal, and that repeatedly went close to the line, I think that's where we're deprived of a fair trial.
Mr. Curran, the SJC did find that one statement, the bald-faced lie statement, was just plainly improper.
Yes.
And then it said, similarly, the second comment about the jury adhering to their oath of office came dangerously close to the line. And it said, you put them together, and then we ask the question of, is it so prejudicial as to require a new trial? And I think that's your strongest argument, not this other stuff about commenting on nobody knows where he was.
Sure.
Okay.
Of course.
So as I understand your argument, you're saying that the SJC, in its decision, had an unreasonable application of federal law in reaching the conclusion that there was no prejudicial error. And you spin that into a due process violation. Or maybe you're making the same argument that it had to be an unreasonable application because it was a due process. So could you just spend a few minutes on that, please?
Well, I think the due process argument was made in the SJC. And I think when you take a look at it, you have to look at it if I know that the Commonwealth characterizes the evidence as overwhelming, and the SJC and the district judge both say that it was a strong case against him. However, it was there was a plausible theory of defense that it was Martin McRae rather than the defendant. The murder took place in Martin McRae's room, and the Commonwealth argued in its closing that Martin McRae had a lot of baggage and was less than an ideal witness, and there were inconsistencies. So I think there was a plausible theory of defense. I think by characterizing this as a bald-faced lie and as a fabricated defense and as something that where the defense counsel is trying to pull the wool over the jury's eyes, it may very well have caused the jury.
Was there an objection at trial to it?
Yes, there was.
Okay.
There were objections throughout the trial, throughout the closing. After the closing, there were very specific objections and arguments made, which is precisely what I'm arguing here. And
so the SJC says they look at whether the defendant objected.
Yes.
There was an objection. Whether the error was limited to collateral issues.
No.
It was not. It went to the credibility of the defendant. And whether curative instructions were given. And they say, well, there were two curative instructions given. And they say whether an error may have made a difference in the jury's conclusion, and they say, actually, we don't think so. So what is unreasonable about the SJC's conclusion there?
Well, I think when we look at the curative instructions, when there were objections, the judge would essentially say, well, you need to make your decision based on the evidence. Never told them to disregard those improper arguments. In his jury charge the following day, he again said, you know, you need to follow the evidence. You need to make your decision on the evidence, not on the arguments of counsel. But there's no specific instruction, you know, you heard an improper argument, disregard that entirely. That never happened.
Was that requested?
I don't recall what was requested. I know there was some discussion, and the judge said, I'm going to give a curative instruction tomorrow in my charge.
No, was it specifically requested that the judge instruct that counsel's argument was improper and you should disregard it?
I
think it was not, but I'm not sure.
I'm not sure either. I don't recall. I know that there was a very strong objection that it was improper. And, when you look at the various aspects as to whether it's prejudicial, as to how serious it was, as to the context and whether it could have made a difference in the outcome, and as to the effectiveness of the
okay, on the could have made a difference to the outcome, the SJC talks about the testimony he had confessed to strangling this young woman.
He confessed to Mr. McRae, who is the person that we that was argued at trial was the person who did the murder. So I think you have to take that with a little bit of a grain of salt.
Okay.
Thank you.
May it please the Court, Anna Lemelski for the respondent. The key point here is that the petitioner cannot point to any Supreme Court case supporting a habeas grant, let alone a case that the SJC's decision was contrary to or was an unreasonable application of. He hasn't pointed to any such case. And in fact, the facts here just don't approach the standard that the Supreme Court has laid out for this type of question, which requires that the comments so infected the trial with unfairness as to make the resulting conviction a denial of due process. And the Supreme Court has also made clear that that is a highly generalized standard, which means that in the habeas context, courts have more leeway to make case-by-case determinations.
You know, the argument suggests that the Commonwealth is saying to the federal court system, you always have to rule against habeas on this assertion of impropriety by prosecutors in the Commonwealth.
Certainly not, Your Honor, but the petitioner does have the obligation to show that it meets the standards set forward by the Supreme Court. And the cases that the Supreme Court has decided in this area, the facts here just don't rise to that level. And if you look at, for example, the Darden case, in that case, the prosecutor referred to the petitioner as an animal who should be on a leash and said that death was the only guarantee against a similar act. Wish someone had blown the petitioner away with a shotgun. So certainly there could be cases where a prosecutor's comments are so inappropriate that habeas might be appropriate, but this is just not that case.
Counsel, I think to some extent Judge Lynch's question may reflect the reality that in these habeas cases and also in cases in federal court involving prosecutorial arguments, we repeatedly find that prosecutors are able to invoke harmless error if we're talking about direct appeal or the highly deferential AEDPA standards when we're dealing in this habeas context. And so over and over again, you'll see comments in the case law, this crossed the line, it was improper, shouldn't have been done, but ultimately it doesn't matter. I mean, what are the incentives for prosecutors to avoid these repeated arguments that cross the line, that prompt courts to say it shouldn't have been done, but there are no consequences for it? Where are the incentives for prosecutors to do it differently if over and over and over again the courts say it wasn't good, but there's really nothing we can do about it?
Well, Your Honor, first of all, I think there's the fact that when you're making a closing argument, if you're somewhat policed by the fact that you don't want opposing counsel to object in the middle of your argument, interrupt the flow of your closing argument.
No. Those are incentives not to do it. We're now asking about, since they do it and they apparently get away with it, what consequences should flow from that? Can you tell us whether there were any consequences to the district attorney, assistant DA, who engaged in these practices?
Well, he did receive quite a significant commentary by the SJC, which certainly no lawyer wants to be told by the Supreme Court of the state.
Does the SJC ever follow up?
I don't know the answer to that.
People can be shamed by published opinions, but did the DAs take any action when they have been told by the SJC that their prosecutors have gone well beyond the line?
Yeah, I don't know the answer to that, but I will
maybe
say
maybe the Attorney General's office should know the answer to those questions.
Noted, Your Honor, but I do think just to come back to this case, I understand the court's concerns, but these cases do need to be considered on a case-by-case basis, and this is not a case that is even close to that line. There were perhaps comments that were inadvisable, but if you consider the full course of the closing argument, as well as the defense argument
that preceded it. I believe Judge Lynch pointed out that the SJC was highly critical of a couple of the remarks that are at issue here, telling the jurors, in effect, it would violate their oath if they took a different view of the evidence than that urged by the prosecution, in effect suggesting that defense counsel was a liar. I mean, those went clearly beyond any sort of appropriate comment. Did it require undoing the verdict? No, for all the reasons that the SJC cited. But those were not small mistakes.
No, we aren't at all disputing the SJC's findings that the
you're missing the point, I think. No, of course you're not disputing the SJC's findings. You're here defending the SJC's findings. I think you've heard some expressions of concern about the policing of a Commonwealth prosecutors that go beyond the line. And the SJC is not an enforcement agency, but the Attorney General is.
We do hear that, and I will take that back to the office, so thank you for that. But just on this specific case, given the precedents that there are, including from this court, we would argue that affirmance is required here. And on the point about the bald-faced lie comment, which we agree was ill-advised, this court in, I believe it was Obershaw, which is a 2006 case, in that case, the prosecutor claimed that the petitioner was lying. So very similar to this case, and it was a habeas case where, and this court described it as a rhetorical flourish, and found that given that there had been an instruction on the point, and that there was no prejudice. We'd argue that case is directly applicable here.
I'm sorry. You want us to minimize these comments, which the SJC said were improper, to nothing more than a rhetorical flourish?
Your Honor, I'm citing a case from this court.
I know, but factually it's different.
It was actually quite similar in terms of the comment that was made.
Excuse me, counsel, but here the SJC itself said that this bald-faced lie comment, which was directed at counsel, it was suggesting that defense counsel was engaging in presenting a fabricated case to the jury. And the SJC said that was in suggesting basically that defense counsel was engaged in unethical and inappropriate comment was entirely improper.
Right. So, I'm not defending the comment, but on the question for this court with respect to
we do understand the difference.
Sure. Okay, but so
I have a question for you. The district court opinion seems to deal with all of these issues de novo, when in fact that is not the role of the habeas district court. The role is to see if there was an unreasonable application or contrary to Supreme Court precedent. Did the Commonwealth argue de novo review to the district court?
No, Your Honor. We put forward the applicable
okay.
standards.
Thank you.
Just one more point, which is that on the oath statement. Just wanted to be clear that with respect to that statement, there was an immediate objection, and there was an immediate curative instruction as soon as the comment was made. The court told the jurors they will make their decision based on the evidence and the evidence only. And then again, during the instructions, after closing.
Mr. Curran's point was a different one, that the comment was improper, and that's what the court should have said, not simply, you don't listen to rhetoric from lawyers, you decide on the evidence.
Well, I think that that instruction can actually be taken as a specific statement that the statement was incorrect. The court said, he referred to the statement, he said, Mr. Zabin referred to the oath, and he said, you will have followed your oaths as jurors when you have made your credibility determinations based on the evidence, whatever those determinations turn out to be. So with respect to that comment, the judge specifically told the jurors that it was incorrect the way it was stated and explained to them what their oath is. So with respect to that statement, we believe the instruction was quite clear. And the Supreme Court, as well as this court, has taken a lot of consideration, looked carefully at what the instructions were in deciding these types of cases.
Thank you both.